Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We're live right now, and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Monday, the 2nd of September. Coming up on the program, the ongoing scourge of building hijacking in Johannesburg, the state of HIV prevalence in Gauteng, South Africa's township entrepreneur ecosystem, it's ripe for innovation, why a diversity strategy is key to business growth, and the two-pot surge is about to begin. Now in effect, South Africa's largely consumer-driven economy is likely to get a financial stimulus from two-pot withdrawals. However, it all depends on how much money is withdrawn. More now from Blessing Utete, Managing Executive at Old Mutual Corporate Consultants. And first up then, what are the potential risks in your opinion for consumers who decide to withdraw a portion of their savings under this new system?
I think the real challenge that we've got is the number of misconceptions that are out there at the moment. And we've seen it playing out in social media at the moment around, you know, people thinking that they're never going to be able to get their pensions. The old rules have gone. Some people think that they're going to get one third of their pension savings as part of the withdrawal amount that's available. So there's a lot of misconceptions out there in terms of what actually two-pot is about. So we still have a lot of education to do, even though we're so close, we're there now.
Do you think this is due to poor communication from all stakeholders, including the funds themselves?
Look, I must say, look, the industry has really pulled together to try and put as much communication out there. I think it talks to quite a bit about just the lack of financial education that we've had across South Africa. And it's just endemic in terms of where we are. As a country, and we can see it through, you know, if you look at our savings monitor, for example, the levels of indebtedness, the levels of people just don't have any emergency savings outside of their retirement funds. So I think it's a number of factors. But generally, I think we have a low level of understanding of financial matters.
All right. The gate is now open as we have this conversation. Let's look at economic impact if we can. How might the increase in consumer spending due to withdrawals have an impact on inflation? And what do you think the potential long-term economic risks might be?
So look, I think the structure of the two-pot system, meaning that the seeding that's available is 10% capped at 30,000 rand per seeding amount, does mean that the quantum that's going to be released into the economy has been managed. So from a retirement fund perspective, the liquidity requirements have been managed appropriately by that cap. However, there is going to be a significant injection into the economy. I've heard analysts talk in the region of anything around 50 billion coming into the economy. The taxman is also going to get a nice injection. I've heard the commissioner talk about somewhere in the region of 5 billion coming in as tax revenues from this. So I think there is going to be a boost into the economy that comes from the access that's coming from the two-pot system.
Just remind us again, for clarity's sake, how the withdrawal process works and what consumers need to be acutely aware of before making a withdrawal, should they decide to do that today.
Okay. So from September now, the employees or members of retirement funds will have access to 10% of their savings that they had as at the 31st of August 2024, and that will be capped at 30,000. So anyone will be entitled to take a once-off annual withdrawal from that savings pot, depending on how much is in that savings pot. So in September, everybody's got an amount that will be seeded from their old funds, and that amount will be available for them to actually access. And thereafter, going forward, the contributions that go into the retirement funds will be split. One third will go into the savings pot and two thirds goes into the retirement pot. So that savings pot will continue to accumulate with a third of members' contributions going forward.
What happens if I'm over 55?
So there's a particular class of members that were over 55 as of the 1st of March 2021. Those people will now be 58, thereabouts. And they enjoyed, when retirement funds changed to annuitization, in other words, all people in pension and provident funds now had to buy a pension on retirement, those people were allowed to retain their rights in terms of taking lump sums from provident funds. So a group of members that were 55 at 1 March 2021 and are still in the same provident funds, those employees or members are allowed to opt into the two-pot system. So they will need to make a choice whether they want the access that's coming with two-pot or not. And that administrators are now facilitating from September onwards now to allow those employees to actually choose to opt into the two-pot system or stay where they are and retain their rights to actually access their provident funds as a lump sum. So it's a category of people that were in provident funds and are still in the same provident fund today that will have that choice.
Is there concern about the ignorance of tax implication, do you think?
I think so. So remember that, I mean, we get quite a nice tax break when we contribute to retirement savings. And when you do access funds from a retirement saving, you are going to pay tax. In this case, from a two-pot perspective, the savings pot that you're going to access is going to be taxed at marginal tax rates. So if you're on a marginal tax rate of 25%, you're going to pay 25% off that savings pot withdrawal that you make. And that's quite a punitive tax amount that you're going to pay. So I think people, you know, they hear the 30,000 and they hear the 10% that's going to be ceded. But when they really look at the sort of calculation and how much tax they will actually pay on that withdrawal, it gives them a very different view of the quantum that they will get. So I think, you know, what we've done is we've actually tried to push a lot in terms of the calculators that people can just utilize to see how much tax they're going to pay on these amounts. And I suppose it also just, you know, to emphasize the fact that this is people borrowing from their future selves. If you take a withdrawal today, you're reducing the amount of retirement savings that you have ultimately.
And I just want a quick thought on philosophy. And let me put to you that the emotional aspect of money decision plays a significant role. And often I think we justify short-term withdrawal based on immediate needs. I understand that. But essential to weigh these against the long-term impact. And that surely is the fear.
That is the fear. Unfortunately, the pressures of today often outweigh the future self. So we can see it when we see the levels of indebtedness. We've done a savings monitor, which, you know, says to us in the last year, over 50% of people have had to resort to a personal loan to make ends meet. We've seen people that have resorted to gambling to actually make ends meet. So the environment that we're in is almost, you know, fertile for people to look after this access for now and forget about the fact that this is retirement savings. And I think that's the sort of message that as an industry we need to sort of continue to push hard, that this is the money that you've been saving for retirement and for a cause. If you don't have a real emergency, you actually shouldn't be accessing this money. We actually should be educating people to have emergency savings outside of retirement funds so that they can actually utilize those before they come to utilize retirement savings. But yes, Jeremy, there are instances where emergencies are unavoidable and so that's where the elegance of this system comes in, to say there is some allowance for people to have some access in the event of emergencies.
Well, the lid on the pots is certainly open. Think twice before investing in that new widescreen television. And Blessing Otete, thank you very much indeed from Old Mutual. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The descriptor hijacked buildings is something uniquely Johannesburg, and my next guest writes that it is one of the most insidious and murky issues that face those who own or manage property, and the enormously negative effect that it has on surrounding neighbourhoods. Angela Rivers, the Johannesburg Property Owners and Managers Association General Manager, is with me now. And firstly then, how widespread is this particular issue? How has it evolved over the years?
So currently, at my estimation, there's about 200 or so hijacked buildings in the inner city. Every year, that number either goes up or down. It's, you know, it's kind of a, depending on the social situation within the economy and all that kind of stuff. What we have seen, I've heard a lot of talk about housing hijackings outside of the inner city, but obviously my expertise is specifically the inner city and the CBD. But I mean, if you look at the whole picture of the inner city, there's about 2,000 buildings in the inner city with 200 hijacked. It's only a 10% problem. So I personally, I think it's something that can be resolved. I've been in the inner city for 20 years, and I've seen the different stages and different types of hijackings that happen depending on different circumstances, economics, cultures, different types of crime, and, you know, all those kind of different factors.
Could you explain the process by which a building typically gets hijacked, the common tactics, in other words, used by the syndicates?
So there's three types of building hijackings. The first is where you have a situation where the tenants decide to stop paying rent, either through circumstance or a tenant community or a little tenant group will form. They will decide as a group they're not going to pay, and the tenants kind of hijack the building. That's really an economic situation. We see that when a lot of the tenants have lost their jobs, they're not getting these government subsidies anymore. So it's really a circumstantial situation. The second that we see is buildings that are privately owned but not well managed. The landlord is not present. The building manager isn't well educated or trained on how to manage a building. The buildings start to deteriorate and it becomes an easy target. But the most insidious one that we see is syndicates actually moving into the building. They intimidate the tenants. Force them to stop paying the owners and say that they are either the new owners or the new managing agents. The building is now theirs, and they then start collecting the rentals and keep pocketing the money. Those are really quite violent. The tenants are under a lot of threat. And because there's such a huge need for housing, it's very easy for the hijacker to just kick someone out and replace them immediately.
Specifically, what do you mean by poor management of buildings?
So what we've seen over the years is you'll have slumlords who all they care about is collecting the rent. So they won't maintain the lifts, they won't paint the buildings, they won't have the buildings cleaned regularly. You know, our JAP Home and members have been landlords for up to 20 years, and we have a very strict code of conduct that our landlords have to adhere to in order to be members. So things like a well-trained building manager who can interact with tenants if they have problems with their bills, they can discuss it with them. If they have problems with the security system, there's a place where they can go and communicate with the landlord or the building manager. It's very difficult. You have good tenants and you have bad tenants. Good, well-paying tenants want to live in a safe environment. They want the security system to work. They want the lifts to work. They want to be able to know that their kids can run around, be safe within the building. So anytime that you let any of that kind of management fall to the wayside, you're going to have disgruntled tenants. You're going to have an opportunity where a hijacker will drive past the building, see from the outside it hasn't been well looked after, it hasn't been maintained, the paint is falling off the buildings, the windows are broken, and they think, well, no one's looking after that building. It's going to be easy for me to just go in there and take over.
Why do you think law enforcement and the cities, and I believe it's called the Problem Buildings Task Team, are struggling to address this issue effectively?
So, I mean, their argument to it is that it's very dangerous to go into these buildings. And yes, it is. I mean, you have a building like Casimir, which is a government-owned building, which was set up as temporary emergency kind of social housing, which has been hijacked. And everyone is terrified to go into that building. We've had several security guards shot chasing people into the building who have done smash and grabs or cell phone thefts. So these buildings, not all of them, but the majority of them are hideouts for criminals. It is quite dangerous to go in there. But, you know, I can understand why City Power would be apprehensive to go into a building, or Joburg Water to go into a building to disconnect water or to do an audit on meters. But they should have the backup of SAPS and JMPD to access these buildings, at least to assess how dangerous these buildings are, because they are dangerous. If you have a building that has no water supply, you're going to end up with a fire. If you have a building that has bad electrical connections, that's just fodder for a fire. But they should be stronger. They should be more of a, they should be working together. I think that's the main thing. They should be working together. You cannot tackle a hijacked building with one department alone. It has to have the buy-in from every single department, from Home Affairs, SAPS, JMPD, City Power, Joburg Water, Social Development, Economic Development. They need to work together as a team and go in as a united force.
So you said to me that 200 out of 2,000 buildings, it is a problem that can be resolved. You've said that it's a multifaceted play as far as different agencies are concerned. How then do you harness that to make sure that there is a quick fix?
So I'll give you an actual example. Last year, November, we have a building called Remington House. Remington House was hijacked for 20 years. It was an absolute slum. Over the last 20 years, it's had about five or six different hijackers take control of the building. No water, no electricity. Sewage literally pouring down the steps. The owner worked together with the city of Johannesburg. They went to court. They got an eviction order. The city of Johannesburg was actually on the court papers to help with the eviction. They helped with the building inspections. They went in. They did an audit of everyone that was living in the building. It took a lot of work from the private sector to bring the city into the party. Once we got the eviction in November, the building was emptied. A lot of those residents chose to move on to other buildings. Some took up the temporary emergency accommodation, which is horrific. It's tents in a field. It's not accommodation at all. But however, this year, November, almost a year later, 168 residential units will be going onto the market. That building has been turned around in a year. And any hijacked building where the city council and the private sector are working together with the common goal of providing housing, it can be done in a year.
Angela Rivers, I'm going to leave it there. The Johannesburg Property Owners and Managers Association, General Manager, appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Compared to other provinces, Gauteng has the third lowest HIV prevalence at 11.9%, which is slightly lower than the 12.1% reported in 2017. This is according to the Human Sciences Research Council, which has released the key findings of the sixth South African HIV prevalence, incidence and behaviour survey for the province. From the council now, I'm joined by Dr. Shadia Ramlagan. And first of all, how would you assess the current state of prevalence in the province compared to others?
Well, Gauteng, we are doing a little bit better than we basically did in 2017, but we are doing quite badly if we just basically look at it overall. So in terms of, say, the country as a whole, the country is sitting at about 12.7% as a national HIV prevalence, whereas Gauteng is sitting at 11.9%. Now, you'd say, okay, fine, that's just slightly below the national average. But the thing is that, like, at 11.9%, that's actually quite bad because that also translates to about 1,720,000 people living with HIV in Gauteng.
Notwithstanding the fact then that we do see a slight decline in prevalence, is there one single factor that is contributing to that?
Well, there is a contributing factor. One is that we are having less births or HIV positive births. So there's less young children being HIV positive. So as the population goes up, what tends to happen is obviously the number of those people, proportion of those people that are living with HIV, although high, the actual proportions go down. So when we look at it, we don't want to concentrate that it's actually going down because the downward is not significant. And it's more due to the actual rise in the normal population, like, you know, because every year the population does grow. But as we basically, the population is growing, we're having less births that are HIV positive. So that is actually a very good thing, and that's what we actually need to concentrate on. And in terms of the world as a whole, we're trying to basically get to zero HIV positive births, and it seems as though we are getting to going in that direction, and that is a very good thing to look at.
And in that regard specifically, the birth factor, what then needs to be concentrated on to achieve that zero number?
Okay. So what we need is that we need people to get tested. I think that's the first very most important thing. If people get tested, they know they're HIV positive, then they can be put on antiretroviral medication. And we know the science does tell us that as soon as people get put on antiretroviral medication, their viral load goes down. So therefore, there's less virus in their body. And if there's less virus in the body, then that means there's less likelihood of the virus being transmitted to the baby. That's what we actually need. So we need people to get tested. Then if they're positive, get put on antiretroviral medication, which is free in South Africa, and to bring down their viral load so their virus is suppressed in the body, and therefore we can actually have this less HIV positive births. Mm.
Why do you think there is still a significant number of people unaware of their HIV status in the province?
Now, that there is a good question, because we are trying to also figure this out. And it's actually quite high, the number of people that don't know that they are HIV positive. So when we did the survey, quite a few people, I think it was like over 60% of those that are HIV positive, did not know what their HIV status was. And this is scary. So people are not being tested. I think what has happened is that maybe people have now taken HIV to just basically being like a chronic disease and are now not taking it as serious as it actually should be taken. You see, the one good thing about when it comes to the HIV treatment is that because our treatment is free and because our treatment is so effective, HIV has now become a chronic condition. It means that in the past, I mean, if you look at it 20 years ago, if you got HIV, HIV was a death sentence. But now if you get HIV and you get onto the medication, you can live a long, happy life. I mean, like up until your natural time of death. So people now have maybe stopped taking it as serious, have stopped going for testing, and this is a problem. So we definitely need people to go out there, get tested, and if positive, get onto the antiretroviral medication.
And doctor, the decline in the use of condoms is also concerning. Are there measures that can be taken to reverse this trend?
So when we were talking with the Department of Health and we were discussing inculcating and we were discussing this very issue, what we stated is that maybe we need a bit more advocacy. We need to basically go down there, a bit more advocacy, a bit more condom literacy. So if you again remember about 15 years ago, there were a lot of adverts about condomizing, like utilizing condoms. Condoms were available everywhere you look, like it, there was always somebody talking about condoms. But if you now look at, say, our social media, look at our billboards, advertising, there's not that much news about condom usage anymore. So maybe that has now led to the decline in the usage of condoms. So some of the discussions that we have been having with the provinces, we've been having with districts, is about maybe increasing the condom literacy, campaigns, condom advocacy campaigns. So therefore, we get condoms back onto the forefront, get it back into everybody's face. So hopefully we can then drive up the condom usage. I think the stats basically show us that in terms of the last sexual encounters for those people 15 years and older, which is obviously our sexually active people, condom use was somewhere around about 30% the last time they had sex, which is in effect very low.
And one last question. I think the antiretroviral programs, if you look at the numbers, have to an extent been relatively successful. But where do you think there is room for improvement?
Yes, our antiretrovirals, given that now antiretrovirals are free and it is available, I think the room for improvement is to get people tested. I think that's the first thing, because once people are tested, if they test HIV positive, they can be put onto antiretrovirals. And that's what we actually need. And the antiretrovirals nowadays, compared to in the past, I mean, like more than 20 years ago, I think 30 years ago, we were taking something like about 30 pills a day. Now it's just one tablet a day, which you actually take. people need to get tested and then need to be put onto antiretrovirals. I think this is where we are severely lacking, is basically at the very first point of actually getting tested for HIV.
And that's a very comprehensive picture that you have painted. Dr. Shandia Ramlagan, thank you very much indeed from the Human Sciences Research Council. I do appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Township entrepreneurs are often forced to navigate an informal and underdeveloped ecosystem. Despite those obstacles, though, they demonstrate remarkable resilience, often leveraging community connection, resource sharing, and innovative problem solving to build successful businesses in a resource-scarce environment. More now from Matsepo Kwape, who is Senior Business Development Manager at the Gordon Institute of Business Science. It's done some important work on this particular issue. And first then, what are the primary challenges that entrepreneurs are facing in accessing these formal support structures?
In our research, and if I may just give you a reason as to why we embarked on this important piece of research and contribution to the space, is that we realized that there was little research that has been conducted to really understand the lived experiences of entrepreneurs. And insofar as doing that is also to understand, is there an ecosystem that exists within townships that entrepreneurs have access to? And so when we produced this research, we realized that actually there are already existing entrepreneurial ecosystems in the township. Even though they're not visible, they exist. And so within these entrepreneurship ecosystems that we've found out is that there are various actors that support the growth, the start, you know, at the beginning of the journey, but also later on as they grow their businesses. So, and that was intriguing to really understand how entrepreneurs have really mapped out who are these actors. So at an early on stage, you're finding that they have a reliance on family support, community support. And then as the business grows in its sophistication, it then, you know, taps into a more sort of formalized ecosystem that exists, like training institutions like ourselves, where we bring capacity building opportunities to the entrepreneurs and, you know, through peer-to-peer mentorship opportunities. So these are what we found, in that this is, you know, it demonstrates that entrepreneurs map these ecosystems in order to access resources and to formulate linkages that are important to for them.
What I'm also hearing you say is that that early self-sufficiency or self-reliance makes them more resilient as their business grows.
Correct. And it's about resourcefulness, Jeremy. And I think that has been a great learning for us and an insight that has helped us then understand how then do we build on what is already existing insofar as the resourcefulness of these entrepreneurs. Because to give you an example, one of our entrepreneurs has indicated in the research that they didn't have equipment. They're in the media space. And so in order for him to do business, he needed equipment but couldn't afford it at that stage. So he went to a community and other entrepreneurs to be able to help him acquire the equipment in the form of renting it and then be able to conduct the business. So it's not seen as competition, but rather co-opetition, that instead of, you know, not making money, I'd rather rent this equipment, pay for it, and then still make a profit that I can put back into my business and grow. So we're already seeing that these are some of the examples of how an ecosystem is connecting and enabling the entrepreneurs to not just see it as a challenge, but then how do we solve the challenges that we face in our community so that we can then be able to run our businesses.
The raison d'etre for any business is growth and profit. So at some point, the entrepreneurial ecosystem is going to have to change for businesses in the early stages versus those in the established changes. How then do you start, or how do the entrepreneurs start to facilitate that pivot?
So I think it's really about arming themselves with the information. Access to knowledge is very important, and information. So one of the key things for us was also to say, you know, in order for you to move from a necessity-based survivalist, because most entrepreneurs really do need to survive. So then they see, for example, the training that we are bringing into the communities as, we are tired, we want to make money. What is the value of me, you know, investing my time in studying when I could be out there making business? And then in that moment, we then give them the information that says, if you want to invest in this, you know, your skills development, entrepreneurial competencies, and the mindset, because I think that's the other thing that's missed oftentimes, is really entrepreneurs who are entering into this journey based on necessity and survival don't often identify themselves as entrepreneurs. And so we do a lot of mastery around personal mastery, but also the mindset, so that you can then see that there is growth opportunities. And so it is really around understanding what is available for me at various stages of my business growth. You would know, Jeremy, as well, is that in leadership development and management development, you start as a junior manager as you work yourself up to exec level. And there's various training interventions or support that you need to unlock your skills, but also to move you to the next level. And so the same lens we apply into entrepreneurship is really that continuum of their development and what we term as the ladder of success, in order to support them and meet them at the point of their need.
Let me suggest to you that the mindset is one thing, but it's also about the practicality of tools. And to that end, digitization is important. And are we seeing the digital platforms are being better leveraged to support the entrepreneurial ecosystem?
Yes, and it was a great insight from the research that came through that entrepreneurs are leveraging digital platforms to do business and to solve challenges that lie within their community. So at our research launch, we had CassiD, a e-commerce business that and last mile delivery that was started by Freddy Mahumani in Tembisa. And Freddy identified a need in the community in that we don't have delivery systems within the township economy, and particularly in Tembisa, where he is from. And he then solved for that by using technology, even though there are constraints in terms of access to data to be able to do, you know, business or to engage with the solution that Freddy was is giving, as well as safety. You know, obviously last mile delivery involves delivery. And how does it become secure? However, this is an example, a perfect example of how an entrepreneur saw a need in the community to say, we don't have Mr. D in the community. We don't have Checker 6060 coming through, but the needs, there are needs of the township, and how do we best service them? How do I create a platform, a marketplace that then gives opportunity for businesses that exist within the township to have visibility on these platforms and then be able to reach wider audiences? And then I think that is definitely what we are seeing again with solutions that are community-led, are community-driven, is that they also become community-embedded. There's this term that we also found out, that this is really a community-embeddedness that occurs when the actors in the form of family, customers, and the community come together to create solutions for the challenges that they face.
All right, I'm going to leave it there, and thank you so much indeed for the insight. Matsepo Kwape, Senior Business Development Manager at the Gordon Institute of Business Science. Thanks so much indeed. And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.